people all over Canada and the United States are doing their part to fight for the future of coffee by switching to Spark Plug coffee. Would you like to know more? Spark Plug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Spark Plug delivers this sensational coffee to you in the U.S. and Canada within 1 week of custom roasting it so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. Would you like to know more? You can order Spark Plug a la carte, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. It's completely flexible and customizable, and because you're a citizen of the Top 100 Nation, you are going to get 20% off your next coffee order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100. So, join the Autopilot Coffee Club and save the world! Subscription guarantees satisfaction. Would you like to know more? Go to sparkplugcoffee.com.
T100 Nation. I like that. T.O. Nation.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy New Year, movie lovers, and thanks for tuning into another year of the Top 100 Project, the nearly 9-year-old effort to review every movie in the galaxy. This is the first week in the 7th annual Month Above. Her birthday is this month. That's why it's the month above. She's programmed our January schedule, so all 5 movies will be ones she selected. For our 423rd Ellis's Analysis, she's got us gabbing about, well, you know by the title of the episode you downloaded, Starship Troopers. I'm the roughneck with a never-ending supply of ammo, except when it's convenient to the plot. Then I'm out of ammo. Ryan Ellis. And here's my blonde and blue-eyed wife who lost 2 or 3 limbs during the war on Klondathu and its surrounding planets, Lieutenant Bev Rico.
That's me. Maybe the man I am today.
If I could go back in time and change anything about any podcast, one of the top 5 things I want to change would be in Forrest Gump, where I would always call him, being a Canadian person, Lieutenant Dan.
Oh.
Lieutenant Dan, you got new legs. Magic legs. But they do lose a lot of legs in this movie. It's a good touch, actually, that people just live their lives. Michael Ironside ends up losing a lot more than that before the movie's over, but he had lost some limbs before, but just goes on. It's what, one of his hands?
It's just his arm.
Half his arm.
His left arm. And people take it in stride as well. But that's what the United States was like after World War I and World War II. They had tons of vets, and Vietnam for that matter. A lot of people came back missing limbs. And the Iraq War. What am I talking about?
It never
about?
Ends.
This is a very common result of a nation that's constantly at war, is that you see vets all the time who are amputees.
And you can survive in the modern era despite those kinds of problems because of modern medicine. And this movie that's set 200 years in the future, the medicine's even more advanced. Because look what happens to Johnny Rico, and yet he survives. And in fact, is even fine after what happened to him. Being in that bath
tank
thing,
yeah.
Like Luke Skywalker was in Empire Strikes Back. He's in there for something like 3 days. And then he's just fine. Okay, the coming attractions opinion question for Starship Troopers, our first episode of 2022. What is the greatest movie satire you've ever seen? Because, of course, this is a satire.
Well, any longtime listeners of this show already know the answer to this, which is that it's the greatest satire ever created, the most pitch black dark comedy ever put on celluloid, and that's Dr. Strangelove.
Why didn't I choose that? That's a great choice.
Yes, it is. It's the only choice, Ryan.
For whatever reason, well, good reason, my mind immediately went to Network.
Oh, I've totally thought of Network as well. Network would be my number 2.
For some people, probably you, Starship Troopers is somewhere on that list.
Yeah, I love this movie.
And in this movie, I said Network, we keep seeing the Federal Network, and you did a parody of that in the Spark Plug sponsor, on television. So television and Network and television in this is a big factor, although more so in Sidney Lumet's movie in the 70s. Okay, Bug Hunt at Outpost 9. Guess that was the original title or something?
It was one of the titles that they threw around, yeah.
Working title, then.
Yeah.
Was released by Sony and Touchstone going on 25 years ago on November 7th, 1997. It basically made its money back, but you need to do a lot better than that to make your film an unqualified success. Didn't inspire a lot of sequels, TV movies, that kind of thing, so obviously they wanted to keep on making products from this. Although it should be noted that apparently underage kids would pay to see something else when this came out, then sneak in to see this R-rated little bit of ultraviolence.
Well, also, there's some pretty serious nudity in it, you're the right age. And I heard that it was quite a bit more successful overseas than it was in the States, because it's a parody or satire of America. if American imperialism was left unchecked, then this is what America would become, which to Americans is not very funny. But I think to Europeans and everybody else all over the world, you're removed enough to watch it and see the it's not the funniest satire, as you pointed out to me, but to be able to step outside and see this movie for what it really is, which a lot of people failed to do when it came out.
And this is 3.5 years or so before 9/11, when it really became jingoistic and militaristic and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, USA, kill everybody who doesn't stand for what we stand for, which wasn't quite as true in the late 90s until 9/11. So in that sense, this movie is a bit ahead of its time.
It's a movie that came out during the brief period when America didn't have an enemy. The Cold War had ended, the Soviet Union had collapsed, and 9/11 had not yet happened. And there's a certain amount of anxiety that goes along with that. This is almost like a 1984 story where you have a country that's invented an enemy. Because without war, this government is nothing. They need a common enemy to unite the people and allow them to have this real totalitarianism.
And it's not even any kind of lie. And even though it's propaganda in this movie, it's justifiable propaganda. Because the bugs are not only a problem, but you don't have to go over there to start a fight with them. That would actually have been an interesting touch if they had to go there and fight these bugs, but the bugs couldn't get to them, or the bugs weren't trying to get to Earth. But the bugs are shooting off lasers, and they're killing thousands and thousands of people on Earth, so you have to go fight them. That would be actually a smarter touch, though, if we chose to go to them, rather than, basically, I agree with what they're saying in this movie, the militaristic approach, we have to.
Okay, so hear this. Humans, capable of faster-than-light travel, bugs are not. They're supposed to be fighting Earth with asteroids, but they say at some point in the film, we're millions of light years from home. Those asteroids are not traveling faster than light speed. How could they have possibly attacked Earth from the other side of the galaxy?
Oh, so that's just an accidental coincidence?
No, it's a false flag. I think it's a false flag. It could be a coincidence. I don't think they ever explain it. And let me explain for people who don't know what a false flag is. A false flag is a government that either takes a natural disaster or some other kind of...
9/11.
9/11 actually is kind of an example of a false flag, depending on who you vote for. But they took this tragedy caused by one thing, one organization, one person, and they used it as an excuse to fight a completely different enemy and to take the country to war, unite the country, although in the case of 9/11, it divided the country pretty dramatically. I can't remember what the event was, but there was something that happened in Germany shortly before World War II that was a big tragedy that they turned into an excuse to start invading neighboring countries like Poland. When you think about it, there's no way the bugs could have blown up Buenos Aires. It could have just been like an asteroid, or it could have been something else that destroyed that city. But they suggest earlier in the film, all the attacks that the bugs have done have been because humans are trying to inhabit their planet.
Right.
They're trying to settle in their planet. It's the Mormons. They went there and they probably wanted to convert them to Mormonism or whatever. And they have the outpost there. And the bugs slaughter the Mormons because the Americans are very much in this movie imperialist. I'm really getting into it. I know we haven't even gotten past the intro stuff. But the movie is about American as imperialists. They are in Buenos Aires. They very intentionally set this in Buenos Aires, but everybody is not white, but they're American. Most of them are white, but they speak English with an American accent.
With the names they have.
Johnny Rico.
Rico, Flores, Ibanez, the top three actors in the movie. Casper Van Dien, Dina Meyer, Denise Richards all have names that are from the Caribbean area and South America, not a typical white.
Yeah, they have Latin American names.
American.
But they look pretty Caucasian and they speak like Americans. Even when you have black characters or characters that you would look at and say, oh yeah, okay, they look Latin American to me, they still act and talk like Americans. So I think the idea is that America is the country that united the world by just basically spreading out everywhere and taking over. So much so that now they're going and inhabiting other planets and it's not going great because the bugs can kill them. But when they needed an excuse to go all out war, because that's when it goes from something people are paying attention to and a common enemy to we declare war on this planet.
Well, you're smarter than me because I didn't think about
it. I've just seen this movie more times than you, I think.
Well, I've seen it, I think, 3 times. Never was a big fan. I watched it not that long ago, actually. I didn't know you were going to pick it for this month, so I saw it in the last year or so. Anyway, let's get into the structured conversation.
And please, sorry.
It's okay. We've done it before. I've done it with Chris many times in our podcasts. It's all right. So give us the skinny, please, on Starship Troopers.
All right. It's the 23rd century, and Earth has united to become one single nation fighting against the shared enemy of a race of alien insects.
As you just said.
Swept up by patriotism and peer pressure, a group of young recent graduates enlist to join the battle and are deployed across the galaxy to take the fight to the bug's home planet, where they are overwhelmed by the enemy and suffer massive, gruesome casualties. All looks lost until a bit of luck helps them discover the brain bug in charge of the Arachnid operation, giving them a major military advantage in the future.
Or, in a nutshell, Argentinian and cohorts get death from above tattoos, and they almost never actually deliver death from above. They send an infantry first, doesn't make a lot of sense. Bomb these bugs, you don't care about anything. Well, unless the subtext, too, is that they want the resources of that planet. But still, wipe out the bugs with an aerial assault. That's what America's been doing forever. They do it now with drones. They did it with airplanes in World War II, certainly with helicopters in Vietnam, and also airplanes, of course, when they would use napalm.
Well, two reasons they did it. One, they vastly underestimated the threat.
There's, again, the Vietnam subtext.
How many arachnids there are, yes. How sophisticated they were fighting, how hard they are to kill, all those things took them by surprise in a very American way, very similar to Vietnam and, again, in Afghanistan. They underestimated their enemy a lot. And the spaceships were under attack and losing people fast. Losing ships very quickly because of those butt missiles that were coming out of the bugs.
Great scene later on towards the end when they're destroying those ships. And one of the reasons why this movie was nominated for its visual effects for an Oscar. The bugs, obviously, but also that scene, which was pretty impressive. I have a secondary nutshell. First one's about war, of course. This one's about love. You have Dina Meyer mooning over you for an entire movie, and you don't spend every waking minute in bed with her?
I know. But if you were going to choose between Dina Meyer and Denise Richards...
I have a confession to make, because around this time, when she was becoming one of the It Girls, there's always a few It Girls, not just one, but Denise Richards was in this, the year after this, in Wild Things. I haven't seen that in a long time. I love that movie. And she doesn't do nudity in this, but she does in that one, and holy crap. And then, of course, she's the main Bond girl in The World Is Not Enough. But maybe Hollywood saw, as beautiful as she is, not that much acting talent. But she doesn't get naked in this movie. Dina Meyer does. The younger me would have preferred Denise Richards. And she still is beautiful, without a doubt. But ever since maybe Saw, or you know what it was? It was Friends. Dina Meyer's guest starring arc for maybe 4 or 5 episodes where she was Joey's girlfriend in one of the plays. They're both actors. Maybe it's the hair. She is the white Rosario Dawson. She is just unbelievably sexy to me.
And for the record, Rosario Dawson is Ryan's hall pass.
Denise Richards, awesome. Dina Meyer, even more so. And of course, they also have more in common. They both play jump ball. She not only worships him, but she respects him. And it's pretty clear that Carmen didn't. There's two important scenes, pretty well written, in fact, because early on, Johnny says to Carmen, "I love you." And you can see the look on her face. She played that pretty well. She doesn't feel it back and she doesn't say it back. But then later on, when Diz says, "I love you" to him, he can't say it back.
Yeah. It's very soapy. They took this plot.
90210 in space.
Well, Dina Meyer was in 90210 as well. And Patrick Muldoon, who's in the Air Force with Denise Richards' character, Carmen.
So Xander.
Yes, Xander.
Xander Barcalo.
He was in Melrose Place.
Ah, okay.
Paul Verhoeven, the director, who we have not mentioned yet, which is funny because this is such a Paul Verhoeven film. Yep. He is an auteur, and this is a very Verhoeven movie. And he has said many times that he intentionally cast people just because they looked the part. He wanted these Barbies and Kens to come right off the set of teen soap and go to war like heroes and then get shredded to ribbons in front of everybody.
It does show, because the cast is not the greatest of all time.
Although, no, but they're not supposed to be good. There's lots of ways the movie's kind of intentionally corny and bad. Part of it is the acting. Part of it is certainly the screenplay. The incredible lines they make these poor actors say. They are very committed and they think they do a great job of it. The only good bug is a dead bug. They just say so many silly things. The music is pure melodrama, taken straight from one of those old Frank Capra movies.
Basil Poledouris did the music, and he worked on Robocop for Verhoeven back in the 80s, 10 years before this, in fact, 87, 97. And I think Robocop, which is also satirical, is a far more effective film, a movie I've watched many times and will see many more. I think 3 Starship Troopers viewings is enough, though. I know what you're saying. And I respect all that. I just think all the ingredients are on the table. The pot's ready. The water's bubbling. All the ingredients have been cut up as well. They're ready to go.
But it's still hard vegetables.
But the chef, well, he knows what to do, I guess, because he's a damn good director. He's made really good movies. Something about it isn't quite working. Maybe it's the chef's fault in this case. Although, I loved RoboCop. We covered Total Recall, well, now I can say 2 years ago. We're recording this in 2021, but we posted in 2022. So basically almost 2 years ago, we did Total Recall. And then the other movie we'll probably do later this year, Basic Instinct. What a trio that was, right in a row for Verhoeven. Plus, he's made other pretty good films. I didn't love Hollow Man, but the effects, as good as they are in this movie, are even more impressive maybe in that, making Kevin Bacon be invisible, especially that first scene where he becomes invisible.
It's funny, the more times I see RoboCop, the more I feel like, yes, this is a good movie, but I feel like I've gotten everything I can get out of it. Whereas the more times I watch Starship Trooper, I feel like...
Trooper singular.
Yes, Starship Trooper, just one. The more I feel like I see something new in it.
I'm the reverse.
Isn't that funny?
Interesting that Verhoeven did movies in these five-year spans. Obviously movies in between, though, too, but 87 RoboCop, 92 Basic Instinct, 97 Starship Troopers. And not so much great stuff since, although that movie L a couple years ago was an effective film and so different than almost everything else he's ever made.
So different, not campy at all, which is such a big part of his style.
He is the ultra-violence director, though, maybe more than almost anybody else, especially here because they talk about it more than they show it, obviously, but hundreds of thousands of people die, and then I don't know how many bugs die.
And they show people dying, and they make it look painful, and they show blood. That scene, I think, is the first... Not the first death you've seen on camera, but the first death you've seen since the opening prologue thing.
Which we catch up to later on.
Yes, when they're in boot camp and they're doing an exercise with live ammo and the guy gets shot in the head. There's a fake head that explodes. You see him on the ground and his brain's on the dirt. And it's so jarring because everything else about this movie is this corny, soapy, Capra-esque war movie, patriotic piece of propaganda. In every other way, it plays it straight as a piece of narrative propaganda. And I wonder if part of the reason that people didn't see it for the satire it was is because it almost does this too well. It follows all those rules too cleanly, and it gives people a movie that they are deeply familiar with because they've seen it 100 times. And so they see the violence, and that's the only different thing. For whatever reason, they just can't wrap their head around the fact that this is making fun of this thing that they're so accustomed to. You would not have to change very many things about this movie to turn it into a straight-up Marvel film.
Or an old John Wayne war film.
Oh, totally! You would just need to change the military into, like, a secretive government operation. You just need to give somebody a superpower that they discover along the way, but the journey and the romance and even the corniness of it would fit right into a Marvel film. Which, by the way, I don't even know if this is a controversial opinion, but Marvel films, they're modern propaganda. The same as those John Wayne war films were. The same as those Capra Why We Fight series films were. Maybe not as directly in the sense that they don't have this clear agenda of how they want to change people's minds. But all Marvel films are very pro-establishment, they're very pro-military, they're pro-capitalism. Tony Stark is a billionaire. Bruce Wayne as well, another example of the good billionaire. It's all capitalist propaganda.
Although Tony does want checks on them in Civil War.
It's Cap, I think, that fights him on that.
Because Cap's idea is we have to go wherever the trouble is and bad things might happen. The other big difference between Starship Troopers and old John Wayne movies or John Wayne westerns or anything in the MCU is there are no consequences. Okay, there are, but not violent consequences on screen like there are in Starship Troopers. Which and that might be the biggest problem is that this movie has a tonal issue because it's got the silliness. It's got these basically vapid actors. Well, Caspar Van Dien is convincing, but at the same time not, if that makes sense. He's an absolutely beautiful man. Chris and I just got through covering Casino Royale at the end of last year. And I said the score factor. We always say, can you score this movie? Because, of course, we're called Scoring at the Movies. Because of Caterina Marino in the middle of the movie, Daniel Craig himself, and then especially Eva Green, that was a 25 out of 10 on the score factor. Well, now the big trio in this movie, and there are other good-looking people, too.
Everybody's good-looking.
NPH, who still wasn't in his own. He looks actually more handsome in Harold and Kumar, which we covered recently, our second NPH movie in
he
about a month.
He still looks like a little boy in this movie.
Right, true, but still a handsome young man. But Richards, Meyer especially, and Van Dien are model material. They're all spectacularly beautiful people. But I do think there's a tonal problem when he has serious consequences in the war, because you don't get those in Marvel films. One of the things people criticized
about
them.
That's why it's not a Marvel film. It's a satire of a Marvel film. Not a Marvel film specifically.
I don't know that people really got... Well, maybe they do now. This is one of those movies that's aged pretty well, according to people I follow online and YouTube shows and that kind of thing. But at the time, I think people struggled with that. Maybe people didn't really appreciate the fact that it can be silly and it can be boobs out. Although I like the fact that when they're in the shower, Dina Meyer's naked, some of the other women are naked, the guys are, we don't see any schlongs. We probably should have. The movie's already R-rated. Just show it off. But anyway, we are seeing people just having showers, and apart from one ass tap by, what is it, a woman on a man, it isn't meant sexually. It is absolutely just matter of fact. This is what happens 200 years in the future. And Verhoeven did the same sort of thing in RoboCop. The locker rooms are co-ed. We see a woman, I think her boobs are out, briefly in the background, not really lingered on, putting on a flak jacket, talking with somebody else, same basic idea 10 years before. But in this movie, they're flat out in the showers, but it's not sexual, even though Dina Meyer taking her top off.
Well, anybody who's ever been to a nude beach can tell you that within minutes.
It's a matter of fact.
Nude bodies just become part of the scenery. You stop gawking. You stop even thinking about it. And what you start thinking is, why do we make such a big deal about this in the first place? So I completely buy it. Actually, the gender politics in this movie are so interesting to me because they treat it so matter-of-factly, just like the fascism in this movie. It's kind of something in the background. You have the main plot, which is this love triangle, but then around them is the propaganda and the war and the gender politics.
The two lady leads are the most qualified people in the whole film.
Yes. They are the ones that can beat up the instructor. Denise Richards is the best pilot, and it's not, she's a girl and she's such a good pilot. It's just, she's a great pilot, and it doesn't make the men scared or threatened. It just exists. And apparently test audiences hated that. They hated that she was ambitious. They hated her for choosing her career over Johnny. And they especially hated that she almost immediately turns and starts flirting with the other guy, with Xander. I don't think she loves Xander any more than she loved Johnny. I think she loves flying.
But they share a passion that she doesn't have with Johnny, so that's maybe why she likes him more.
But it's kind of like a matter of convenience, is the way I read it. Now, if it was a man character that was like that, leading some woman along, but then wanted to pursue flight or whatever, any career, nobody would care. And this movie doesn't care, because if gender politics keep going the way they are, then that is the journey that we'll take, and eventually people will not find that shocking or offensive. Also, in really warlike nations, the Nazis, I don't know enough about this to really speak on it, but I know that they paid more respect to their women. Communism, the Russians, women were strong, and they were part of the Republic, and they were fighting along with the men. And it was not Starship Troopers level. We're not talking about the 23rd century, but it was progressive for its time in that sense. I'm sure on the ground it looked like something different.
I would follow Dina Meyer's character in this movie, so Diz or Carmen, even though I've criticized Denise Richards in the movie, her performance. But I would follow the characters that have been written into battle in a second.
Now, when push comes to shove, they all just follow Johnny. They follow the good-looking white man, the Ken doll, the G.I. Joe, who's in charge. And no matter who they are, no matter how qualified they are, how long they've been doing it, almost accidentally, they all are like, we're Rico's
keeps
Rough
getting
Riders.
Promoted in a matter of weeks, it seems.
You compared it to the Star Trek reboot movie with Chris Pine.
Chris Pine in 2009.
He just keeps accidentally
He's not even supposed to be on the ship. He ends up being the captain when the movie's over.
So ridiculous. And it kind of feels like that because everything takes place so quickly. Another realistic thing about war, the people would get promoted really quickly because people keep dying. If the casualties are really high, then someone who's been there for 6 months is a veteran compared to all the brand new kids who genuinely look young than the young, well, they cast adults to play teenagers as usual. But the actors that they have coming in as the new recruits
look like kids.
They do look like kids.
Okay, so let's talk about the bona fides for Starship Troopers. It got 66% of critics on its side. 6 out of 10 was the average on the strength of 68 reviews on Rotten Tomatoes and 70% of audiences, so a fresh tomato. The other Starship Troopers series, TV movies, etc. that you find on Rotten Tomatoes, something like 4 or 5 of them, maybe even more than that, were just blazed by Rotten Tomatoes. They didn't get good ratings at all. The movie was 35th at the 1997 U.S. box office. Titanic, which we covered for the Top 100 Project, was number 1, still one of the biggest hits of all time. Men in Black was number 2. We covered that. L.A. Confidential, we covered that. What a great movie. Was 24th. And Wag the Dog, which we also covered, was 52nd. There's a good satire as well, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned already the movie was nominated for visual effects, but lost out to the very deserving Titanic.
Are you a Titanic apologist now?
I think for visual effects, it's even more impressive than this.
Yeah, okay, you're right.
Titanic uses visual effects to aid its story more so. And a lot of the time, you don't even see that there are effects.
Yes, it's the difference between using effects to dazzle people and using effects to immerse people.
And this movie actually does both of those things not too bad. Like I said, the effects hold up pretty well, I think, for 25 years now.
Yeah.
So we know you liked it. We don't have to go over that because you picked it for this month, and I'm not a fan. I don't hate it. I'm just not a fan like you are. If I was ranking it out of 4 stars, I'd give it probably 2.5 or a very generous 3. Ed Neumeier, who wrote the screenplay, also wrote RoboCop, which I think was a better screenplay, but some similarities. And he wrote Starship Troopers, Traitor of Mars, which was a couple of years ago. And I think all the actors from this, or the main ones, did voices in that. I guess it's animated. But he did write some pretty good subtext, like that whole I love you from Johnny to Carmen, and then later on I love you from Dizzy to Johnny that's not returned. Another thing that works pretty well, though, because I said I would follow Dina Meyer's character into war, and that's not just because I'm obsessed with her, but she is a pretty well-drawn character for the most part. But she's also, fittingly, in their jump ball game, which is basically football with some tweaks, the quarterback. Mm-hmm. Well, who do you follow in football? The quarterback. They set the tone. They're the ones that pass the ball. But she's never even considered to rise through the ranks. Jake Busey, bit of an it boy at this point, because he was in this Contact the same year as this, in a villainous role. Enemy of the State, one of the many pretty good young actors in that, in smaller roles. It's not his fault. He's one of those people that always looks weird and menacing. But he's not weird and menacing in this movie. But at one point, he's offered the chance to be in charge. No, I just want to go to war. I know I'm not ready for this kind of deal.
Well, he chickened out. He thought he wanted to be in charge, and then...
But no one even suggests give it to Diz.
No, there's a black character later on who...
Sugar.
When there's a vacuum in power, he's just like, Rico's in charge. You're pretty good too, bro. You're just as qualified as he is.
Yeah, that's Seth Gilliam from The Walking Dead. And, of course, The Wire as well. He went on The Wire first, then The Walking Dead. He's still in The Walking Dead even now. He's been on the show a long time. And I think maybe the sugar reference could be maybe a play on slavery. Picking sugar cane, that kind of thing. Yeah. I don't know, maybe.
Hundreds of years later, they have all this gender equality, but they still have a legacy of slavery.
Maybe that's not what it's meant by the writer. Well, the book writer was Robert Heinlein. He wrote the 1959 book, and apparently it was serious.
Yeah. Paul Verhoeven was asked to do this project. He started reading the book, and then he just got bored, and he just asked the screenwriter to describe it to him, because he's like, this book is bad. I don't like it. I don't want to make it like this. And he turned it into a satire of itself. It is an earnest piece of propaganda that's maybe not specifically written for the government, but the message in the book is that joining the military gives you grit and turns you into a better person and makes you more qualified to be a citizen. It's earnestly making the argument that only people who serve should be able to vote.
Right. And of course you got Neumeier and Verhoeven working together like they did on RoboCop. And I don't know Verhoeven's entire lexicon. He made some Dutch films before this, which were pretty lauded, I think, in Holland or Netherlands or whatever you want to call it, before he came over here.
He's from the Netherlands. He's from the Netherlands.
There you go.
Before... And he grew up in Germany-occupied Netherlands, too. So he has a first-hand experience with fascism.
So the movies I know, though, he wasn't really much of a satirist. But in RoboCop and in this, he is. And he's using the same writer. And we talked about sex movies because L is that. And, of course, so is Basic Instinct. That, I think, is legitimately hot and sexy. Maybe because Sharon Stone is so good in that film and so beautiful, of course, too. But the one that came before this, the movie he made 2 years earlier, was Showgirls.
Also a sex movie.
Which I guess is a satire, too, come to think of it.
You say this is a soup that's missing an ingredient, or you forgot to turn the stove on, or something about it that is just half-baked for you. I'm mixing my metaphors, but I think you get what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's fine just the way it is. But Showgirls, wherever he failed to stick the landing in Starship Troopers, he really missed the mark in Showgirls. It's like he was trying to make a satire, and he just ended up making something so over-the-top stupid. What is he satiring? He's making
satiring?
The bad movie.
Satirizing?
Yes, satiring.
Peppa's not doing too well today. She's not feeling all that great the last couple weeks.
I'm rallying, okay? But if I don't find a word, it's because I'm under the weather.
You know the key thing with Showgirls, though? Because I never loved the movie, but I did find it pretty sexy. Because I was 21 when it came out, I guess. Did have a girlfriend at the time, though, so I wasn't single. But anyway, I think one of the reasons why that movie works better, at least, because I didn't think it was a good movie when I saw it the first time or other times. I think I've seen it at least twice. But when somebody said, maybe it was a reviewer, which I would have read later because I wasn't on the internet in 1995, when they said it's All About Eve, or a parody, a satire of All About Eve, I got it more. It doesn't entirely work. And maybe because, much like this movie, he didn't cast the best actress. You can't say Elizabeth Berkley didn't try. And she's been pretty good in other things, like Roger Dodger. Mm. She's pretty solid in that smaller role. She's committed to it, but she's not very good in it. You could say the same thing about Denise Richards in this movie. Very sexy women, not untalented, but at the same point, you want to, I know I sound like a 47-year-old dick here, but pat them on the head. Nice try. I believe Dina Meyer more than I do Denise Richards by a mile, and even Casper Van Dien, who is a bit of a Ken doll, but at the same point almost feels like he could have been, when he was at his best, James Franco in the same time frame, or that kind of actor really gets into roles, but he's such a beautiful man. At the same point, again, you almost want to pat him on the head and say, nice try.
And it reminds me of the poor man's David Lynch film, because David Lynch makes satires. Blue Velvet is a great example of a movie that starts out as a suburban melodrama and then delves into this world of absolutely insane violence, the likes of which Hollywood audiences had never really seen anything like before. And it gets so weird and it gets so dark, but it always maintains that 50s clean cut, oh gee whiz, white picket heart.
And sometimes terrible dialogue.
Terrible dialogue.
In his case, I think deliberately.
Intentionally bad acting. And I feel like as his films have gone along, he does that more and more. Mulholland Drive is a great example. You have an actress giving both the best and worst performance of her career in the same film.
With the same dialogue. Yeah, when she practices that scene.
Literally the same dialogue. Yeah,
when she practices the scene earlier in the movie with Laura Herring, Naomi Watts seems silly. But when she does that scene with that actor, Chad something, man, I want to see that movie itself, not
right.
Just a two-minute scene. That is a little bit hot, sexy, even though it's a little problematic, but so well played by both of them, especially Watts. But yes, earlier in the movie, when she's doing the exact same dialogue, it seems stupid.
Yeah, she's being this goody-goody, clean-cut American girl. I really think that's what Verhoeven is going for here, too. He's a good director. He's gotten great performances out of actors in other films, and he knew exactly what he was doing when he cast these people. He didn't want them to be good actors. He wanted them to be corny.
Okay.
He wanted them to be TV. It's lit like a television show. It looks like it takes place in a high school.
It also starts in high school because after the opening propaganda, the video we see that is later in the film, and we don't realize at the time, it's Johnny's the one who's yelling at the cameraman, get out of here, we gotta go. Because he's got the helmet on, you can't really tell that it's Casper Van Dien at that point. And that cameraman, as I said, when we watched the movie, is very dedicated because he's still getting shots. He finally gets killed, but he's just sticking in there and getting
the shot for it.
Until he finally gets killed by a bug. But then when the movie starts properly, yeah, you get the propaganda video. But when we actually start with our story, you get the four main characters, including NPH as Carl. They're all in class together, so they're in a high school. So there you go, the high school movie. And then they have the bug dissection scene where Denise Richards vomits. The kind of thing you could have seen in any 90210 type episode back then.
Totally, yeah. The dissection scene has taken place, I think, in every single high school show that ever made it to the second season.
Do people always vomit when
there's always one character who either makes a big scene about morally objecting or is so gross out that they have to run away and leave the classroom. It's a cliche.
Johnny's just digging into that thing with abandon.
As is Dizzy.
Yeah, and Carmen can't handle it, though, at all. The Federal Network parody stuff, the satire stuff, the propaganda stuff on television basically works. I do think they should have pushed it harder. Verhoeven should have gone even more hardcore like he did in RoboCop. To make it even more clear that it's satirical, because it might be a little bit too subtle. But the thing that's not subtle earlier in the film is when we have a commercial with kids loving guns. Although that's not funny anymore, because that's what we see. Who was that person that recently posted? Well, a lot of them do it, but we saw this on Twitter. It was trending where you've got a family of, I don't know, maybe five kids.
Is
Lauren Boebert's family that politician? Anyway.
It was a politician. I can't remember.
So that's become serious. They think it's just cool. Look at us with our gigantic weapons are longer than we are.
And this movie was pre-Columbine too, so I think it wasn't as offensive either. The very beginning starts with all these soldiers saying, I'm doing my part to save the world. And then a little boy in full soldier's uniform, I'm doing my part. And they all turn and they laugh. That's a shot-by-shot remake of Triumph of the Will, a very famous Nazi propaganda film by, I wrote it down somewhere. You probably know her name off the top. What's her name?
Lenny Riefenstahl.
Yeah, very famous propaganda film, and he copied it shot by shot. He also copied stuff straight from Why We Fight, those old Capra war propaganda films.
That phrase is actually in this movie, too.
Yeah.
And there's a pretty good documentary that I recommend to people called Why We Fight, made maybe 15 years ago.
Is it about propaganda?
Yeah, that's the idea. Wow. That incorporates the infamous video of Eisenhower saying when he was leaving office, be careful of the military-industrial complex. One of the worst things in the movie, though, we talked about dialogue that isn't very good. I don't know if this is supposed to be laughable. Maybe Verhoeven, being the imp that he is, meant it to be this way, but I did laugh out loud, and I'm not sure it's supposed to because hundreds of thousands of people just died. But when she turns to Johnny and says about Buenos Aires getting eradicated, that's home. You saying to me, if we were on a vacation and found out Toronto got nuked, that's home. I'm aware of this. I live there, too.
Well, that's playing to the cheap seats, right?
It must just be
some corny, on-the-nose exposition.
And that's when Johnny has quit because of what happened. He got whipped, another violent scene. Probably a little bit of a play on the Jesus Christ metaphor. In RoboCop, I never noticed this until Verhoeven talked about it in the commentary, and now whenever I watch the movie, I can't not notice his Jesus metaphors, including the way that Alex Murphy is just shredded and killed, and then towards the end, when he's walking on water as RoboCop and some of the other things that he goes through in that film. So in this, Johnny got whipped, playing off of Jesus in some way, and then he's out. He's going to go home to his family, but then once back in after what he sees happen. He's Richard Gere in An Officer and a Gentleman. I got nowhere else to go. That's also the Chris Pine and Star Trek thing. That's where I started realizing that maybe Star Trek was playing off of this movie with that character, at least. Same basic arc where, what are you even doing here? You don't belong here. And then you end up being in charge of everybody before the movie's over.
But it's also just a common popular arc. It's popular for a reason. It makes a really watchable, fun movie.
What about those tacky death from above tattoos they all get? The four of them at least get them.
I like your point that they're death from the ground. They're not death from above.
And they can't make the decision to not attack from above. They finally do, meaning the whole military, and they start winning when they do that. But yes, death from above makes no sense unless they're Carmen and Xander in a giant airship, although those things seem to stay in space. But that would make more sense than calling the grunts the infantry. Maybe, again, that's Verhoeven being smart and slick. I don't know. Maybe I'm not giving enough credit for this.
Kind of reminded me of Full Metal Jacket, where you have these characters that are supposed to be lovable and you're rooting for them, but they're really violent people who are taking pleasure from their kills. To tattoo it on yourself. I am death. I am the one that kills from above.
I think that's also one of the many nicknames that Drago has in Rocky IV.
Death from above?
Death from above, which doesn't make a ton of sense.
Because he's so tall.
Tall, that's the only reason why, exactly. And Russia's north of America geographically, I don't know, it's kind of dumb. We haven't even really talked about the villains. Not that they have a character, they never speak English, of course, but the bugs, we see at least tens of thousands of them portrayed in this movie. Pretty impressive visual effects, as we said already in 1997. I'm sure it'd be even more impressive now. They'd probably overdo it if they did now, though. But there's that whole subplot where the bugs, or that one at least, the head bug is sucking out the brains.
With a thing that comes out of something that looks exactly like a vagina.
Yes, so you've got a, much like Alien, penis thing coming out of a Well, actually, what it was in Alien, the original design was way more vagina dentata idea, where it blatantly looked like the body parts of a man and a woman, the reproductive organs, either a penis or a vagina, well, with them combined. And obviously it's still penile, an alien, if you will. But then in this movie, yeah, you've got both of those, especially with the thing that sucks the brains out.
One of the most gruesome scenes there are, too. It's not particularly gory, but, it's visceral. Yeah.
And Xander starts to get sucked in, basically, because his insides are being sucked out. That's obviously a visual effect and pretty well done. That may have actually not been digital. It probably was, but that's the kind of thing you maybe could have done with some kind of puppet.
You can see they have stunt heads. This was made in 96, 97. They had to have been using as many practical effects as they possibly could. There's so many digital effects that are in the movie, but they were really expensive at the time. Mm-hmm. So anytime that they could get a puppet in there instead, I'm sure that's what they were doing.
We've talked about in other movies we've covered where the best visual effects films have had way more real effects, puppets, Jurassic Park and T2 included, two of the best visual effects movies of all time. But there's not that many computer effects in those movies the way you think that there are.
Just a couple of well-placed money shots.
The modern films, that's way more true, and this would be more in the vein of the Jurassic Park T2 mode. This was shot apparently from April to October of 96, and then came out in latter 97. And when they're on one of those planets that looks very deserty, well, they were shooting in a desert, and apparently they were dying, they were so hot.
Oh, those uniforms, they must have been miserable.
Because they're always, well, not always, but generally fighting during the day, too. So it's whatever, 120 in the sun, probably 110 in the shade, and they're shooting all day long. And a very physical film. When those scenes especially are happening, Van Dien in particular, because he's always in those scenes. He's our main character.
And they never break a sweat because they have to keep looking cute throughout.
Until they're covered in viscera and gore. Because in a very short period of time, we lose Michael Ironside, who's their leader. He gets ripped apart, torn in half, in fact, and then you know what to do. Johnny doesn't want to do it, but he does kill him, because that's what Razik wants him to do. But then right after that, Diz gets impaled by a bug, and then she dies on the ship. So in the movie's time frame of maybe 10 minutes, we lose two very important characters.
And Xander's not long after that, either.
A little bit longer, and I think it's supposed to be a whole different mission. But in movie language, we've lost two hugely important characters in a very short period of time, and that's when they start realizing, oh, maybe we can win this, but maybe you can't if you're going to lose two valuable people like that. How did you kill Dina Meyer? How could you? when they actually capture the head bug, and it's supposed to be that Clancy Brown, who is the drill sergeant, who's breaking people's wrists and arms and legs and everything else in boot camp, probably again satirical. I didn't think it was funny, but I can see why the satire is there, because we've seen a lot of boot camp type guys, but never actually, or rarely at least, actually causing physical damage. They can fix lasting physical damage, but what does he break? Jake Busey's arm, is it? No, it's Eric Brascotter's arm, the guy that played the catcher in Major League 2. And then you see this weird thing on his arm when they're having lunch or something. He's in the chow line, and obviously just fixes it nice and easy. But he's the one that apparently captures the bug. And when they have that thing tied down like that, and they're all, yeah, we got him, yeah. And then they show what's going on in the lab, which has to happen for humanity to win. But even so, because of the way it's shot, and I'm sure this is intentional, I felt sorry for that bug.
Totally. I fully feel like you're meant to feel sorry for that bug. When they say, he's scared, and everybody's rejoicing because he's terrified, which of course he would be. This is the bug's home planet, and all of these aliens have come and invaded and killed a bunch of his people, for lack of a better word, in a war that has just turned, and they might be losing, and now he is at their mercy. He has every right to be afraid, and then what do? They torture him, they're drilling holes in him. And here's another interesting touch in terms of propaganda. When you see them do that, they censor it. When you see the arachnid attack the cow earlier in the film, they censor it. But when they show the Mormons slaughtered, they show all of it. You see the people torn to pieces, body parts here and there. There's nothing censored about that. So it's like they want you to see the dead people, but they don't want you to see the torture that they're putting the aliens through or the cow through. Well, then no, it's too much for your sensibility, but we want to outrage you about people suffering.
But even in that, as I recall, the viscera and the gore that flies off into the corners of the screen, you see that.
It's true.
That's not censored.
Yeah. But Verhoeven knows what he's doing. He wants you to feel sorry for this bug, and he wants you to think about the fact that these bugs didn't do anything to deserve this.
Well, I thought that they did actually nuke Buenos Aires because I wasn't smart enough, I guess, to realize that you're probably right, that was,
you know, I'm taking credit for it, but I'm pretty sure that that idea was put in my head by my ex-boyfriend, who at the time was also a fan of the film, and we talked about it a lot, and it was his idea that it was a false flag. And then as soon as you start thinking about it, it would take them more than millennia, it would take eons, millions of years for something that they put into motion over their home planet to hit Earth.
They were coming after our bacteria. And by the time they got humans, they're bigger targets. They're better looking targets. Yeah. And they're dumber targets.
But they do suggest, I guess this is supposed to be true in the film, that the bugs have evolved to travel interstellarly, biologically. So when they put those spores into outer space, it is meant to hopefully hit another planet and then colonize that other planet. So they are an invasive species in a way, but the idea that they have invaded Earth is maybe a little harder to believe, quite a bit more far-fetched.
What you just said about the spores thing is what's happening in the remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. There's spores that come to San Francisco and then start getting inside of people's brains.
But how can we be mad at a species that does that when humans over and over again have invaded every corner of this planet and certainly would not hesitate to invade other planets if we had the technological
and to wipe out species.
Sure.
Whatever they may be. And if they're dumb and ugly, then even more so, we just say, oh, go ahead and kill them.
So true. If you're not cute, well, then we really don't have to worry about you.
We don't see NPH very much in this movie as Carl, but he becomes Colonel Carl, and he's dressed very much like a Nazi.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's also that going on here, too, the Nazi symbolism and the fascistic violence. And again, this is pre-War on Terror, and you said it, too, pre-Bowling for Columbine, a movie we're going to cover this month. I don't know if you chose your five movies, and we'll start talking about them more as the next couple weeks go out, obviously, intentionally to have a bit of a theme, but I realize that some of them do. There's even a bit of a theme between this week's movie and next, but it's not going to seem like it is on the surface. And I even changed the plan because we were going to do Bowling for Columbine next week, but this is right in the holiday season as we record this podcast. I wanted a shorter, easier one to do, but there's still a connection between this movie, and we'll talk about it very soon, next week's movie.
Another cutthroat, bleak movie that is a comedy. The movie we're covering next week is Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Well, I was going to do it later.
Yeah. But it's another really pitch black comedy.
And a satire in some ways, too. So Casper Van Dien was a voice in Starship Troopers, Traitor of Mars, a couple of years ago. He was also in Sleepy Hollow back in 1999. Done a lot of movies, but never really took off. He's got the looks. He's not a bad actor, but
I feel like he's too perfect looking. He really looks like G.I. Joe or a Ken doll.
If he had children with Denise Richards, or I think, again, even more so Dina Meyer, wow, those kids would be flawlessly pretty, because these three people are flawlessly pretty.
But he's like one of those good-looking people that is objectively hot, but doesn't really have sex appeal. At least not in this movie. Maybe in other movies he could, but in this movie, I know he's not sexless, but he just seems so clean-cut.
Actually, as much as I've been raving about her, that's true about Dina Meyer, too. And deliberately, because she is a tomboy, even though she's Dina Meyer. The biggest tragedy in this movie, despite all the deaths, is actually whenever they tie down Denise Richards or Dina Meyer's hair. Because they both have outstanding hair.
That's true.
Let it flow the way it does, especially Meyer with her curly-ish locks. We covered NPH, like we said, last month in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. I don't know if we'll do any other of his movies in the future. He didn't do that many movies. I guess probably Gone Girl one day. Maybe we'll do that.
Yes.
Pretty important role in that, too. And, of course, Doogie Howser and How I Met Your Mother on television for him. You got three at least. Maybe there's more, but three guys in this movie from Total Recall. Michael Ironside was a major role in this and a pretty important one as the guy going after Arnold in Recall. Marshall Bell, who's the Quado guy, if you will, has Quado inside of him. He's the simpering General Owen who gets wiped out by a bug that just lands on him and crushes him. And then Dean Norris, got a smallish role as one of the guys in charge in boot camp. He's Tony, the guy with the melted-looking face in the stripper bar in Total Recall. So we've mentioned Verhoeven's credits, probably most of them, especially his North American ones at this point. He's a very enthusiastic director, almost method. Because apparently in the shower scene, when all these people are naked, Verhoeven and his cameraman, Joost Vacano, were also naked.
He was like, I'm European, this is not a big deal.
And I guess that relaxed the actors.
The nudity is not really that sexy. It is.
No, it's not at all. That's the point. Much like in RoboCop, briefly in that one. That's his whole point, I think, is that we'll get to this point one day where we'll get over the fact that, oh my God, there's a boob. Oh my God, there's a penis. This is body parts. Move on, grow up. We talked about his writer, Ed Neumeier, who did write Starship Trooper, Traitor of Mars, a couple years ago, and RoboCop. The producers were John Davison and Alan Marshall, Neumeier and Phil Tippett, one of the visual effects guys. He's a legend. We're co-producers on this. Movie's 185-1, we saw it on Stars. I just mentioned Joost Vacano shot it. Also shot RoboCop, Total Recall, Showgirls, and Hollow Man. So he and Verhoeven worked together over and over again. The editors, Mark Goldblatt and Caroline Ross. Goldblatt worked on the two Terminator films for James Cameron, and Ross worked on the TV show The West Wing. And the composer, Bezo Palladour, she talked about the score, worked on the Conan films, great music in those, RoboCop, and he's worked on a rich variety of genres, actually. And the last technical person to mention is Dale Dye, who trained the actors, has a very brief role in this. And he trained actors for boot camp type stuff, military films, Platoon, Saving Private Ryan, I think Forrest Gump, and a whole host of others. What did you think of the look, the cutting, and well, you mentioned the music already.
Could be shorter.
It's not even that long. It's barely over 2 hours.
Yeah, but I feel like there are parts where it drags a little bit. Obviously, there is a flaw, and maybe it's the beginning where they allow us to believe that the bugs really were the aggressors who blew up Buenos Aires. And maybe that's in the screenplay, maybe that's in the editing. Maybe if that was more clear, it would hit for you.
Yeah.
The look, like I said, it looks like a TV show. It doesn't look great. It looks like it's all in a studio, or it's overlit. Everything's just too clean and polished.
But Vacano can shoot a beautiful movie, because I think Basic Instinct
totally
is a very underrated looking movie.
It's intentional. You know, Verhoeven said that he wanted the film to have a fascist society, but where everything works exactly the way that fascists want it to work. So the trains do run on time, and everybody's attractive, and there seems to be an abundance of wealth. Everything is perfect in this world, but fascism, even if it fixes all those little problems in your life, is still a system of violence that needs war. And there's still a great deal of suffering that goes on, and it has to go hand in hand with lies. So I know he really intentionally wanted it to look very polished, and he was copying the polish of these really pretty Hollywood films that are meant to gloss over all the ugly parts of life. So it's intentional. I like it because I think it works. I think it actually is perfect for the film.
As for what happens next, they all die on the next mission because the bugs adapt after the setback when their leader is captured. They're capable, why not? Doesn't have to be just one key bug.
Can't be the only brain. There's no way that he's the only brain bug.
And they basically were winning almost every time they fought each other. The bugs won over the humans over and over again.
And they're the home team. We see it on Earth among humans, even when you're vastly outmatched technologically.
Vietnam again comes up.
Exactly. Afghanistan. Nobody has ever managed to win that war.
When you're fighting for your home and the other people don't have as much at stake, and there's an awful lot more politics back home, yeah, no wonder. Unless you're willing to go all the way and start dropping fire way more than they ever did in Vietnam or nuking countries. I'm not advocating that, but that's pretty much the only way you can win in those two places, and that was proven. But America keeps on being Three Stooges. Whoa, 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 whoa. We can do it this time. And the voters keep on listening.
We're not learning lessons. It's not just America, it's human nature.
Well, true, but America has all the real power with all their nukes and such. Okay, well, then, last thoughts on your first movie of 2022 and the month above as well, Starship Troopers.
Well, I guess I just hope that maybe I've changed your mind a little bit here. It kind of sounds like I've gotten through to you somewhat.
No, I don't latch on this one.
No.
My issues are still the same. The whole thing about it being a setup in Buenos Aires, if that's true, that's a key point, absolutely. Much like when somebody said, hey, the movie he made before this, a satire too. Think of the Showgirls arc. Oh, that makes sense. Doesn't make it good. Makes it a little bit better. Well, same with this then. That helps. Not enough, though. I just didn't really care. I almost wish they'd all been killed. Well, they're likable enough. I shouldn't put it that way. They're not unlikable people. But then look at Carl. He ends up being a colonel. He looks like a Nazi. God knows what they're doing. Well, he's one of the ones that's probably making the decision to just torture this bug, which maybe they have to do to beat the bugs.
I don't root for them the same way I don't root for anybody in Network. But Network has a character, a through-line character, who's kind of the cipher for the audience, who sees through everything and is wiser and above it all.
William Holden.
That does not... Yes, William Holden. I couldn't remember his name, so thank you. That does not exist in Starship Troopers. Maybe that's a secret sauce that's missing for you, too. There's no cipher for the audience to stand back and observe and be critical about what's going on. The audience has to do that work, and it's not done for us. I don't root for anybody in this film. It's almost more of an intellectually interesting and highly amusing, but I would never say that I'm emotionally attached to anyone.
But you still love it. You said at the end you think it's a masterpiece.
I do.
Okay.
It's my favorite Verhoeven film.
Wow.
I wouldn't say it's his best film. I think RoboCop is his best film. I agree with you. But RoboCop, I don't know, it just doesn't scratch the itch for me the way that Starship Troopers does. There's something about it. It's even darker in its glossiness. Does that make sense? I love things that are so pitch black. You know that I have the bleakest sensibility when it comes to satire especially.
Okay, in 7 days we'll talk about something far quieter and far humbler, but it's a satire in its own right. I've said it a few minutes ago. Todd Solondz's Welcome to the Dollhouse. The coming attractions, this is a new thing, factoid. It's not really even an opinion, certainly isn't trivia, more of a factoid. Don Wiener in the movie is called Wiener Dog by the bullying kids at school. You might not want to relive this, you, the listeners, me, anybody, but what's the worst nickname the kids at school ever gave you?
Oh, I got it.
Because Wiener Dog's not that bad, but it's bad enough.
Oh, man. I'll save it for next week.
Maybe this is cutting too close to home. Cut to the bone.
So for my sad answer that I'm afraid to say out loud, lest I revive the demons, tune into our next week's episode about Welcome to the Dollhouse. And for more from us, you can visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Brian is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. It's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive. That will get you a 20% discount.
Do you want a podcast forever?
And cut.
I guess you don't. 'Cause you're cut.